My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you and conferences like this and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th of 1973, and for that I'm eternally grateful. That is a Texas introduction. In case there's anybody here from Texas, I don't want them going back saying Albert didn't give his sobriety date. I'm so pleased that Hollis could work me in between the golf presentation and the ice cream bar. I want to thank the committee so very much for the invitation to come and be a part of this conference. I agree with Cleve when he said last night that this is a very special conference, and you are very special people, and you are very close to our heart. And I want to thank Marie and Hollis. They picked us up at the airport, and we went to dinner with John and Eileen, and we've been eating ever since. I want you to know, 2 days ago when I arrived on the island, this coat came together. And it's just been overwhelming for Sally and myself. I mentioned that I have a lovely Al-Anon wife, and this coming June we will have been married 38 years, and I would like for my Sally to stand. That is a very strong lady. And, you know, Sally is not an Al-Anon because she's married to a drunk, and she's not an Al-Anon because she's married to an alcoholic. She's an Al-Anon because she's very active in Al-Anon. And she brings the principles of the program into our home and into our love for each other, and I think most of all into the healing of the family. And I hope I will talk a great deal tonight about the healing of the family, because I think we're dealing with a disease that is powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. We have four children. We have a daughter that's 36 and a son 34 and one 32 and one 27. And as I try to relate the family story tonight, you will see how alcohol has touched their lives. And I've sometimes, I guess I'm curious over the fact, you know, if we cripple the children with the disease of alcoholism in the home, we shouldn't be too startled when they begin to limp in society. And I forget sometimes when my children are having problems that it's the disease of alcoholism, and I forget to recognize it. I can see it in your children, I just can't see it in my own because I have expectations and I don't have the ability to accept what I should. You know, I have a small feeling of inadequacy standing up here tonight. It's not a new feeling for me. I've always had kind of annoying sensation of inadequacy, but it's, you know, this is such a special conference, and I would like to do something to wow you tonight, and I would like to say something special for Marie and for Hollis and all of the people that have loved us so much. But every time I ask God for that special wow, all he ever says to me is, just share your experience and your strength and your hope and your common problem, and that's what I do. I've always had this feeling that I didn't fit. I think I was addicted to approval long before I was addicted to alcohol. It was very unnecessary for me to have your approval. And I think people talked to me about my attitude long before they talked to me about my alcohol. I remember my father saying to me, God, you are a hard-headed kid. Oh, you are a hard-headed kid. I remember my mother saying to me, do you have to win all the time? I remember later on teachers and instructors and coaches saying to me, is it necessary for you to do that? And so as I look back, I think people probably talked to me about my attitude long before they talked to me about my drinking. It seemed to me that most of my life was motivated by fear and anxiety. And growing up, I always had two wishes. The first one was I always wanted to be someone else. I never wanted to be who I was. And if I could just be him or if I could just be him, or if I could just be him, I would be okay. And that other gnawing sensation was, if I could just be somewhere else. If I could be over there, it would be okay. If I could be with them, it would be okay. I wanted to be anywhere other than where I was. And you know, if you begin to judge people by your standards, and you don't know what your standards are, you begin to think funny out there. I'm not moderate about anything. Sobriety has not changed my thinking all that much. Sally is still frightened to send me to the grocery store for a quart of milk. I remember one time I went for a quart of milk and I came back and she said, "How much was it?" And I said, $60. Because I can fill up one of those carts doing nothing. You know, I left home not needing anything. And I can fill that up, and all of a sudden while I'm in the store, I need it. Happened to me today when I walked through the Golf Pro Shop. It's a funny thing. I'm with Hollis, and I bought a slick. I didn't need a slick. I mean, I've got 18 already. But when I walked in the room tonight, Sally said, "Oh, I see you got a slick." I said, "Yeah, I just didn't want to get caught in the rain." It didn't rain out there today. But you know, I can still use up a year's supply of anything in 2 weeks. Because that's just the way I am. I remember I was in the service. I was in the same one that Cleve talked about last night. The big one, the WW2. And I was on a disembarkation base in California with 95,000 other sailors. And we had a weekend leave, and I was just going to this town. It was Hayward. It was 27 miles from the base. And we were just going over to have a couple drinks that weekend, and we were going to leave on a Friday night, and we were going to hitchhike back Sunday, and everything just sounded so simple. And I remember I got back a couple days late, and there were some people who were very upset and angry about that. And I remember these fellas with the shore patrol and the 45 came into this barracks where I was and put me in this jeep and took me over in front of this captain, this very responsible man with much braid on his cap. And he started to talk to me about my behavior once again. And he said, "I see your record in boot camp is not all that bad. Your behavior on the base hasn't been all that bad." And as we talked, out of nowhere, he said to me, "By chance, do you have a problem with drinking?" And up here, my alcoholic mind said, "Heavens no. God, I'm 18 years old, and I'm an Iowa farm kid, and I'm away from my family, and there's a war on, and I'm frightened, and I'm scared. And if I wasn't here, and if I could get back home to Iowa with my mother and my dad, I wouldn't drink the way I do, and I wouldn't feel the way I feel." And I remember I got out of the service and I went back to the University of Iowa in 1946 and somebody mentioned entrance examinations, mathematical skills and communication skills. And I remember saying to myself, "I haven't been to school in a long time and I haven't studied. And God, I'm just, what'll they say if I fail those tests?" And I fixed that by going across the street to the tavern and having a couple of drinks. And pretty soon, you know, it was okay. You know, I was raised by a mother that solved all the medical problems of the world with a Vicks jar and a piece of flannel. It was incredible. Sore throat or sore elbow, it didn't make any difference. Mother would just start rubbing the Vicks on and then the flannel would come. And then Cleve talked about it last night. He mentioned three feathers. There was also four roses and old Guggenheimer, some of the real high dollar things. But Mother used to make the hot sugar water and lemon and then two or three jiggers of three feathers or four roses or whatever. And I remember she would give me a couple of sips of that and I would just kind of break out in a warm sweat and go to sleep and it'd be okay for a little while. And you know, that's what drinking and alcohol did for me. It made it okay for a little while. And when I'd get that anxiety and that fear, I could have a drink and it would be okay for a little while. And when you find something that takes the fear out of your life, it's difficult not to use it. At least it was for me. One night in an Iowa tavern, they didn't serve liquor by the drink in Iowa after the war. This was a little college tavern called the Foxhead Lounge. And I walked in and I saw this girl, absolutely the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen. And I thought, in true alcoholic fashion, that's mine. And I just had one problem. I was engaged to another girl. But you know, that's no real problem for alcoholics. When we decide to go to that side of the room, to that side of the room, we don't tell anybody. We just go. And I remember I turned to this fraternity brother of mine and I said, "Do you happen to know that girl?" And he said, "Yes, that's Sally Sears from Des Moines." And somehow, I can't remember how I got her telephone number, but I called and I said, "Sally, this is Sugar Myers." And I just think we ought to get together. Now, if you talk to alcoholics long enough, we'll get you. And I want you to know that in 3 weeks' time, I cashed in all my war bonds, got drunk, bought a ring big enough to go over her thumb, called the dorm and said, "Sally, would you meet me out front at 10:30? And she came out. I could hardly get the car parked, as drunk as I was. And she got in the front seat of the car. I put the ring on her finger and I said, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life?" And I don't want to tell you how sick she is. She said yes, because I had told her, "You know, when we're married, I won't drink that much. When we have a family, I won't drink that much. When I get a good job, I won't drink that much. When we buy the house, I won't drink that much." And you know, Sally believed that, and I believed that. And we got married, and all of a sudden we were two frightened young kids that were addicted to approval again. We wanted so much to be a part. We wanted that feeling that he talked about last night. When you drove by our house, you would nudge each other and say, "Boy, there's a nice young couple that live over there." And Sally and I didn't know anything about having kids. We didn't have a manual on children. I'm fascinated that God's most precious gift is turned over to rank amateurs. We thought you were supposed to have children because that was part of the scene. That was part of it. And you didn't have one, you had many. I don't know how it is now, but after the war, we had children. 3, 4, 7, 8, you know. We had to replenish the stock. And I remember we started to have children, and Sally and I didn't know anything about marriage. We didn't know anything about functioning for the well-being of another person. You know, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. My having a love affair with Sally, a good love affair with Sally, doesn't have anything to do with Sally. It has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. And when my behavior is bad, my love affair is bad. And it's that simple. I've always been in sales, and Sally and I moved around a lot, and we were transferred to Kansas City and St. Louis and Syracuse. I'm a young, aggressive guy, and I'm coming up through the ranks, and I work for a large corporation called Owens Corning Fiberglass, because that was the security of our time, if you could go to work for a large corporation. And every time we would get transferred or moved, you know, Sally and I would gather up the four children and the dog and the goldfish and the station wagon and pack it off, and we'd start down the road. And invariably, she would say to me, "This time it's going to be different. This time we're going to keep track of all the checks in the checkbook." That was a big one. We always got that up front. But you know, we tried to benefit from the mistakes that we made. And the thing that we didn't see was the disease of alcoholism. You know, it's such a deceptive disease. By the time it deceives you and by the time you deny it, you can look right at it and say, "We don't have that problem. Sally never called me an alcoholic. I drank too much sometimes, or I drank too much at the wrong times." We were transferred back to New York. I was given a tremendous promotion, and I went back to New York, and Sally went up into Connecticut to look for a home. And she found a lovely home that was built in 1812 by a sea captain. It was just a very romantic thing to live in and talk about. And my offices were at 56 and 5th in the glass building, and I would commute back and forth. And, you know, if you were to stop me on the street and say, "Albert, how are you doing?" I would say, "You just can't believe how great it is." You just can't believe how wonderful it is. I have this great job, and Sally and the children are up in Connecticut, and everything is going great. And I really wanted to believe that so desperately, but on the inside I was bleeding to death. You know, I didn't know how to live, and I didn't know how to die. It just seemed to me that I would exist one day at a time, hoping one or the other would happen. Because Sally and I did all of the things that you told us to do. You know, we just numerically went down 1 through 100. And when you added it all up, it should have fit. We should have been happy. And I remember I came home one Friday night, and I had been traveling for several weeks. And I landed into New York, and I was drunk, and I leased a car and drove up to Connecticut. And as I came through the door, always thinking, you know, that Mr. Wonderful is here again, Sally said to me, "Albert, I can't live like this anymore. The pain is just too great." And I would go into my alcoholic, sarcastic routine, and I would give her one line of sarcasm that would tear the flesh, and I would just say something strong. And then Sally would say to me, "Do you mean that?" And then I would go into my alcoholic routine and say, "Do I mean what? What you just said, well, you know what you said." "Hey, I don't know. What did I say, Sally? Tell me what I said." And then Sally would say to me what she thought she heard, and then I really knew she was all mine, because then I would say, "I did not say that. You took it all wrong. I did not use that tone of voice." And if I could get Sally to talk to me long enough, sooner or later she would say to me, "Albert, I'm really sorry for misunderstanding." You see, if I could get her in a fight, I had a chance to win. The thing that killed me was the silence. I couldn't stand it. And I said to Sally, "Hey, look, I've worked hard, babe. Damn, come on, give me a break. You know, let's talk about it in the morning after we've had a little sleep." And on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, Sally one more time said, "I would rather be dead." And she took a razor blade that was sitting on top of the dresser and went to the master bath and attempted to cut her wrist. And I'm there screaming, saying, "Hey, my God, does my drinking bother you that much? I can't believe that my drink... I'll stop drinking. Just don't do that." And these four small children are in the bedroom listening to Sally and I scream at each other about, "Please don't kill yourself." I've been very privileged in this program to work with the Alateens. And the Alateens tell me that the disease of alcoholism has a sound to it. I've talked to Alateens that say, "Albert, I can put one foot in the house and determine the condition of the home immediately by the sound. There's either too much noise, which is frightening, or no noise at all, which is deadly silence. Or there's yelling, or competitiveness, or sarcasm, or profanity." And they say, "I either go to my room and turn up the radio, or I go to the phone and call a friend, or I go out on the street because there's less pain there." I had an Alateen say to me one time, "You know, if the sound of your house is the same today as it was a year ago, chances are you aren't growing." And I started to think about that. And Sally and I talked about that, and it's been a very important part of the reconstruction of our marriage and relationship, because there were certain sounds in our marriage structure that always caused pain. I'll tell you one that lasted for 35 years. I would come home on a Friday evening very innocently, and I would say to Sally, "How'd you like to go out for dinner?" "Great." And we would get in the car and we'd start down the highway, and I would say to Sally, "Where would you like to go for dinner?" She'd say, "I don't care." I'd say, "Well, let's go to Vincent's and get some fish." "No, I don't want fish." "Well, let's go get some barbecue." "No, I don't want barbecue." And within a short period of time, the conversation went like this: "Well, damn it, then let's just go home." Now, I want to tell you, 9 times out of 10, when I would say to Sally, "Where would you like to go for dinner?" and she would say, "I don't care," that's the way it ended. And the Alateens taught me, you can't get into that kind of trouble if you don't ask the question. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to say Bill Sears, which doesn't mean anything to you, but that happens to be Sally's brother. And whenever I would say Bill Sears, she would defend him and I would tear him down. Within a short period of time, I would go out the door saying, and I still think he's pretty dumb. And I hadn't been in the program very long, and I said Bill Sears one night, and right on cue, we started this. And I'm going down Central Expressway in Dallas thinking, resentments is the number one offenders. It kills more alcoholics. And God, I can't be like this. And I drove over to my sponsor's house. And I said, Chip, every time I say Bill Sears and talk about Sally's brother, we get in this fight and she doesn't understand. And he just let me rant for a while. And he finally said to me, Albert, didn't you have a drinking problem? And I said, yes. He said, what did you do about that? I said, I don't drink anymore. He said, well, it would seem to me I wouldn't say Bill Sears. That only took 26 years. I've had Alateen say to me, you know, my dad was profane when he's drinking, and he's now 2 years into the program, and he's still profane. When's he going to grow? And I have to say, I don't know. You know, sound is so important. A couple months ago, one of the grandsons called, and we were talking just prior to Christmas, and Corey said to me, Grandpa, he said, you know, I love to come to your house better than all the rest. And I said, why is that, Corey? And he said, because it's quiet. And I started to think about that. And I started to think, here's a 9-year-old boy who loves to come be with his grandpa because it's quiet and it's secure. And that's what the program and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have placed in our home. I managed to get my arms around Sally that morning, and we took her to a psychiatrist. We always took her to a psychiatrist. Somehow we figured out if we could get her fixed, I would be okay. A very well-meaning psychiatrist listened to both of us for about a month, and then he said, what the two of you need is a geographical move. We'd only moved 9 times prior to that. But you see, we were Iowa farm kids, and we were out of our element in this New England area. And if we just go back to the mid-continent area of the United States, we would be all right. So one more time, we packed up the kids, the dog and the cat, the goldfish, and we headed for Iowa. And we bought just the right house in just the right part of town, next to the school, next to the church, with enough bedrooms and a big yard. We put it all down there, and it should have fit. And the one thing we didn't write in was the disease of alcoholism. And I became a periodic drunk. It isn't that I didn't drink every day, because I drank almost every day, but some days, and I can't tell you why, it just seemed like the temperature was right and the moon had been full, and somebody said, let's go to Chicago, and I said, terrific. And then 3 or 4 days later, somebody would say to me, why did you do that? And I would say, I don't know, it seemed like a great idea at the time. Every drink I ever took seemed like a great idea at the time. I was in a meeting last week. I was telling Hollis, it was a young guy, about like Jeff. He was talking in this meeting, and he said, I don't know whether I'm alcoholic or not. He said, all I know is when I drink, I act like one. That's about as profound as you can get. I finally, after one of these 4-day safaris, they gathered in my living room. I call them they because I don't know where they come from, but I returned home and they were in my living room, the attorney and the doctor and Sally, and they were saying, now you need to go to the alcohol and psychiatric clinic at the University of Iowa. And when the evidence becomes so tangible that you can't duck anymore, you begin to say funny things like, well, if you think that's what's best, you know, okay. And on a Monday morning, a man talked to me, had his white coat on, and I'm sitting across the desk, and he is saying to me, Albert, it just seems to me that when you drink anymore, you get in an awful lot of trouble. And I said, yes, John, that's so. He said, it seems to me that when you drink, you hurt people. And I said, I'm sorry about that, but that's true. He said, let me tell you something about alcohol. He said, there are certain people that are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. Your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain. I said, God, John, I'm allergic to alcohol. He said, that's correct. And he said, I'm going to tell you what I'd like for you to do. I'd like for you to talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like for you to go to an AA meeting. And in September of 1967, a magnificent man who is now dead by the name of Gil Boss did it exactly the way it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, working with others. And he took 3 to 4 hours of a very busy Friday afternoon that he didn't have. And he made the time for me. And he talked to me about the guilt and the shame and the degradation and the DWIs and the divorces. And he just went on and on. And up here my mind is saying, that hasn't happened to me. That hasn't happened to me. That hasn't happened to me. God, I must not be alcoholic. I remember going home and telling Sally, I said, you should have heard that story. God, if I get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. And Sally and I went to an AA meeting in 1967. Now, I'm going to tell you something. We knew about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sally's father came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1952, and he had 25 years of continuous sobriety before he passed away. We knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. Terrific for him, the way he drank. You know, I didn't make it until 1973, and I remember saying to Dad, Dad, my God, why didn't you talk to me about my drinking? I mean, I took everything that you loved in this world. I took your daughter, and I took your love, and I took your money, and I took your booze, and I stripped you of your dignity, and you never once talked to me about my drinking. And this magnificent man with just piercing blue eyes just looked me right straight in the eye, and he said, you would have resented it so much coming from me that it would have ruined the opportunity for the right person to reach you. And then he said something that I've heard many times since, you know, God made us all different, so we need each other. If he made us all the same, one of us wouldn't be necessary. And more than that, he has gifted each one of us with the ability to touch one other human being that nobody else can touch. I'm almost willing to bet that everybody here tonight is here because one other person had the ability to reach in and touch you deeper than all the rest. You know, Sally wasn't silent for 26 years. Man, she gave it her best shot. The attorneys and the doctors and the clergy, they all gave it their best shot. And one morning in a halfway house in Shreveport, Louisiana, a retired electrical contractor, 74-year-old man, put his hand on my shoulder and said, you don't have to do that anymore if you don't want to. I haven't had a drink since. Don't you know Sally went crazy for 24 hours trying to figure out what he said? I went on this drunk one more time, another periodic, and all of a sudden there were people in my living room that said things like, we're going to take your house. And we're going to sell it, and we're going to keep the equity. And we're going to take the furniture, and we'll give you some basic furniture to live with, but we're going to take the rest of it and auction it. And if I close my eyes right now, I can still see Sally and the 4 children standing on the lawn. And the house is gone, and the furniture is being auctioned off, and we did not see the disease of alcoholism. Tough time again. 3 of the 4 kids were gone because every opportunity they had to leave, they left. I used to think, oh, terrific, they're going off to college. Hell, they never came back. I had a letter from my daughter one time saying, you'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same. The oldest son got into drugs, hit the campus in the late 60s, and sold and bought and trafficked and jailed for drugs. There was a period of several years that Sally and I didn't even see him. The communication was so bad. We heard he was living in a little shack on the Iowa River, and one holiday season, Sally and I went up to see him, and we had taken some presents, and we went to the door, and he came to the door, and we went to hand him the presents, and he just put them down on the ground and said, I'd rather not be associated with you. And we thought he was living funny. And the middle son did what a lot of the young people do. He just backed out. He just quietly left. He was gone. And young John was too young to get away. He couldn't buy his way out, and age wouldn't do anything for him, and Jonathan had to stay. And I used a friend and got a job in Shreveport, Louisiana, and Sally and myself and John went to Louisiana. And one night in Shreveport, I looked in my rearview mirror and there were some Caddo Parish police deputies trying to get me off the street. Thought I was driving funny, I think. Cleve mentioned last night, you know, I'm going to tell you, you know, Louisiana Caddo Parish police deputies have a magnificent reputation for being mean. And so I thought I would be very careful, and I pulled this car over just as carefully as I could, and I remember saying, hey, I'm going to be ready for these guys. And these two Caddo Parish police deputies came around to the side of my car, and I just had electric windows, and the window went down, and they said, could we have your driver's license? And I said, sure, you bet. And I just handed it to them out the window. And then I made a grave error. I rolled up the window and drove off and left them standing there. You just have to take my word for it that that makes them real mean. And the second time they got me stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. They just removed me from the car, and I remember being thrown over the hood, and the handcuffs are going up the back, and my alcoholic mind is saying, God, I hope nobody's watching this. You know how the cars are just going by. And we get down to Texas Avenue, and they throw me in jail and do all the things that they need to do, and somebody said to me, you can make a call. And I remember that fear that I had when they said, you can make a call, because people had said to me, just don't call anymore. We don't care. And so being a good salesman, I called a good customer, and Frank came down and got me out of jail. And I remember saying to Frank, Frank, let's go get a six-pack and straighten this out. And God works in strange ways, because Frank said to me, why don't you come to my house and spend the evening, and tomorrow morning we'll try to figure out what to do with you. And I remember when Frank said to me, tomorrow morning they're going to try to figure out what to do with me. Hey, I'm kind of a high-class guy. I mean, I've had big jobs in New York with large corporations, awards and recognition. And he's saying things like, they're going to try to figure out what to do with me. And I remember I watched this clock in the kitchen. It was one of these big West clock. And it finally got to exactly 6 o'clock in the morning, and I called this Episcopal priest, and I said, Father Paul, this is Albert, and I want to tell you something. I'm in big trouble. And he said, can you get down to the church? And I said, yes, I think so. And I remember I started to talk to Father Paul, and he said, Albert, I want you to go to this halfway house. It's called the Bridge House on Stoner Avenue. And I'm thinking, halfway house? Hey, I'm a high-class guy. Halfway house? You know, some of us get here because we see the light. Others get here because they feel the heat. That morning, the heat was on, you know, and I began to say, okay. And I remember I went down to this halfway house, and I sat it down at the end of a table, and there were three old railroad timers there and my retired electrical contractor. And one man said to me, when did you have your last drink? And God, all of a sudden, you get this feeling like you know it's over. This volcanic type thing. And when they said, when did you have your last drink? I said, I had my last drink last night, and I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks, and the house is gone and the furniture's gone, and they're about to pick up the car, and Sally wants to leave, and three of the four kids are gone. And I heard one of them turn to the other one and say, God, he sure sounds like one of us. And one of them said to me, would you do anything to get sober? I said, God, I'll do anything. Guy said, would you go to 7 meetings in a row? 7 meetings in a row? God, I swung around and I saw them. There they were, live and let live. Easy does it, and I knew what those were. Man, I'd seen those in Sally's dad's house. These guys are talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to back out of the boat, you know, and this old electrical contractor just kind of put his arm around me, and he said, Albert, we need to go for a ride. He said, I have to go over to Shumpert Hospital here and visit with a friend in the alcoholic ward. And I thought, oh boy, I know what they're doing, you know. And on the way over to the hospital, this is what he said to me. He said, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. And that's all he said. And I started thinking about that. And the priest was right, and I could relate to him. I didn't know how he was doing that, but I loved that cure. And we visited with his friend, and on the way back to the halfway house, he set the hook one more time, and he said, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. He said, as a matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow. I said, Bill, how long have you been doing that? He said, what's that, Albert? I said, they've not quit drinking. He said, 27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow. He said, Albert, there's something you need to know. Nobody ever took my right to drink away from me. You know, we alcoholics have a hold of this rock, and we're going to the bottom of the lake, and everybody around us is saying, let go of the rock. And we're saying, hell no, man, go to the bottom. God. I said, but Bill, how are you going to take away my freedom? He said, freedom? He said, let's talk a little bit about freedom. He said, you know, I have this dog that I put out in the backyard every day. It's within the fence. He said, it just barks at the birds and soaks up the sunshine, has plenty of food, plenty of water, and I come home and love it every night and take it inside. He said, now I could let that dog be perfectly free and open up the gate. And he said, it could get out and get run over by a truck or picked up by somebody that doesn't love it or go without food and starve. He said, it seems to me, of the two freedoms, I'd rather have the one on the inside of the fence. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. You can be as big and as free as you want to be as long as you stay on the inside of the fence of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, but God, Bill, I'm a salesman. Jeez. And they're still out there, Bill. And God, I'm going to go back out there and go to work, and somebody's going to take me to a bar and ask me if I want to drink, and I'm not going to know what to tell them. And this old Louisiana man turned to me and he said, you want to know what to tell them? I said, you bet. I said, tell them you can't drink that stuff. It gets you drunk. I said, is that it? He said, of course that's it. He said, you do understand when they drink it, it gets them drunk. I said, I never really thought about that. Now, up here, I thought, that may be fine for him, but that will never work for me. You know how you think when you... That's great. Promises are wonderful for you. But I want to tell you, I was in the program 90 days, had a brand new job. One of the ex-Dallas Cowboys was selling media in the off-season. Came to my office, took me to a place called the Hungry Hunter. We went right up to the bar, and Dave said to me, Albert, would you like to have a drink? I said, oh, God, Dave, I can't drink that stuff. It gets me drunk. He said, oh, geez, don't drink it. I said, I won't. I think it's Elsa C. that says, we wouldn't worry nearly so much about what people thought about us if we realized how little they didn't. You know, people could care less what I do. This marvelous old man said to me, you will come to the halfway house at 10:30 every morning. He said, this is a relatively simple program. You just don't drink and we're going to change every other area of your life. He said, you will not travel anymore. I said, Bill, that's all I know. He said, I don't care. I said, what am I going to do? He said, you're going to sell used cars. I said, I've never sold used cars. He said, I don't care. You're going to start selling used cars. And I began to say funny things like, yes, sponsor. And I went to a Dodge agency that was owned by a gentleman by the name of Donaldson that I used to play golf with at the country club. And I said, Mr. Donaldson, I need a job. And I need a job selling used cars. And you know, 3 or 4 weeks went by and everybody else had a car to drive home except me. And one weekend, Papa Donaldson called me in and he said, Albert, I want you and Sally to have the biggest Dodge on the lot for the weekend. And I want to tell you, I've had some awards and I've had some recognition, but nothing has ever served me any better than the fact that the man would trust me with that car. Sally and I didn't have any money, and I think we gathered up what change we had and we bought a cassette, Ray Conniff, Bridge Over Troubled Waters. And we drove and played that thing for about 48 hours straight. And we were like two kids, you know, two kids that had been reborn again. You know, there's a magnificent story about the little boy named Teddy. He wasn't retarded, he was just slow. And he was the brunt of a lot of laughter and jokes from the other kids. And he went to school one day and the teacher said to the children, I'm going to give you each a container. And I want you to go find something that was created by God that's beautiful and bring it back tomorrow for show and tell. And each of the kids picked up their container and they left. And they came back the following day and the teacher began to call on them one at a time. And she called on Herman and Herman brought his up and they opened up the container and on the inside was the butterfly. And the teacher said to Herman, only God could have created something that beautiful. And then she called on Jane, and Jane brought up her container, and they opened it up, and on the inside was a rose. And the teacher said to Jane, only God could have created something that beautiful. And then she called on Teddy, and Teddy brought his up, and they opened it up, and it was empty. And all the kids began to laugh, and the teacher said to Teddy, Teddy, I don't understand. Your assignment was to get something that was created by God that's beautiful. And Teddy looked at the teacher and said, the most beautiful thing that I know of was the resurrection, and that came from an empty tomb. You see, I think sometimes God reduces us to nothing. He washes out the bad so that we can be filled with the good. He takes away the sickness. You know, I think we really are. I think Cleve mentioned it last night. We are the resurrected few. And I think we are so privileged to be here. So privileged to be here. Sally and I went to Dallas in December of 1973, and we didn't know a soul. And we had John with us, and John was so angry he used to keep a loaded shotgun in the bedroom. And when I would go to see John, John would just put his hand on the loaded shotgun. And he couldn't stay with Sally and I, and he went and lived with a family in Shreveport for 6 months, the first 6 months of my sobriety. And I went to Dallas to go to work for an RCA distributorship, a job that had been arranged by my sponsor, driving a car that had been co-signed by my sponsor, with enough money in my pocket to buy groceries and pay rent from my sponsor. Because my sponsor taught me that anything I'm fortunate enough to have, the clothes that I wear, the money in my pocket, the car that I drive, came from exactly the same source as my sobriety. And Sally and I found a little club called Alpha. And she started working the steps, and I started working the steps, and we started bringing the principles of the program, Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, into our home together. And about 11, 12 years ago, Sally and I were looking at houses one weekend. That's what alcoholics do when they don't have any money. They look at houses. We're just trying to fill up a weekend. You know, that or big cars. It doesn't make any difference. And Sally and I were looking at this townhouse, and this lady was saying to us, it's only $50,000, 5% down, 8 3/4% interest, 30-year loan, be very easy to finance. And Sally and I were giggling and winking at each other because I had tried to cash a check for $25 the day before, and somebody wanted two major credit cards and my driver's license, and I didn't have two major credit cards. And that evening I called my sponsor and I said, Bill, you'll never guess what Sally and I were doing today. He said, what's that, Albert? I said, we were looking at townhouses. He said, tell me a little more about that. And we talked for a while, and out of nowhere he said to me, would you like to buy that townhouse? And I said, well, of course. He said, well, write a letter. I said, to who? He said, the loan committee that lady was talking about. Did you ever notice how we alcoholics are scared to lose something we don't own anyway? He said, you write this letter to the loan committee and you tell them your name and who you work for and your area of responsibility, and you're a very active member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sally writes her name and says she works for this group of doctors, and this is her area of responsibility, and this is she's a very active member of the family Al-Anon group at Alpha in Dallas, Texas. And you know, it still fascinates me to this day, you know, that, and I read it in Honesty, you know, when they read How It Works tonight, in the first three passages, there's three different references to honesty in different places in How It Works. You know, it refers to honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And you know, on a Monday morning, Sally and I took this letter, still have the letter, and we drove up in front of this Oak Cliff Savings and Loan, and we held hands in the front seat of the car, and we said together, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. And there was a certain quietness that came over the front seat of the car that morning. And somehow Sally and I knew that it was okay. Whatever happened was okay. And I remember we walked into this Oak Cliff Savings and Loan, and this little loan officer was there. And you know, I hate those questionnaires even to this day, because the first question is always, if you have lived there for less than 1 year, list below. And alcoholics always put C attached. We got a long... And we got down to credit, and I said, we don't have any credit, and we don't have any money. And this man's head just kind of, you know, began to write, but I said, oh, we have this letter. I wanted to say, well, my sponsor told me to give you this letter. But I said, we have this letter. You give it to the loan committee, and then you decide whether Sally and I should be a part of your community or not. And I guess it was 4 or 5 weeks they called and said, come get you $50,000. I've been privileged to sponsor a lot of people that come to me and say, Albert, I just can't get it started. You know, I can't get a car. I can't get a boat. I can't get a house. I can't buy land. I can't do anything. And I say to them, why don't you write a letter? And they say to me, that'll never work. I said, well, why don't you try it anyway? And it's just a matter of time that Sally and I get a call, and on the other end you hear, you'll never believe what just happened to me. And I could fill up this podium. Because you see, hey, I had a sponsor who carved the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in his life so that I could touch it and see it and feel it and believe in it. I want to tell you something. Sally and I have been a big fan of Cleve and Nell for a long time. You see, alcoholics are great watchers. We watch, and we watch. Now, it's very important what you watch. You know, when the sponsor says, hey, pick the winners, pick the winners. But I would tell you something. Sally and I met Christopher when he was like 4 years old. I think Nell told me last night he's 17. And Sally and I have watched that family. And we've grown with that family. And we've felt for that family. And we've had emotions for that family. And part of the healthy structure that is in Sally and myself and our children, we got from Cleve and Nell. You see, because I'm convinced at this point, the way the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works is, you take care of my children, and I will take care of yours. Because I can't look at mine without expectations. I can look at yours with complete acceptance. Sally and I were privileged to run a meeting one night, and a man came in kind of late, and Sally said, is there anything anybody would like to talk about tonight? And this guy raised his hand and said, yeah, I'd sure like to talk about something. He said, I just got out of this treatment center, and I have this crazy wife and 4 kids, and God, if I could just get them straightened out. And we tried to throw a net over him for about an hour. After the meeting, I went up and I said, my name's Albert. He said, my name's Jim. I said, what do you do, Jim? He said, I work for Owens Corning Fiberglass. I said, oh my. We became friends and I became his sponsor. And one day Jim said to me, why don't you come back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass? And I said, Jim, I said, there's a little black card up there in my folder that says, don't ever let this gorilla back. And he said, no, Albert, we've changed our position on that. He said, we have a very active employees assistance program. And of the 24,000 employees, over 1,900 of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why don't you write a letter? I knew who to write. And I wrote a letter. And I said, dear guy, you know, if there's any chance at all, just beyond my wildest dream. And within a short period of time, they wrote back and said, would you please send a resume? And I knew they had a resume up there in the folder, so I just gave them an AA resume. September 6, 1973, driving while intoxicated, jail, Shreveport Jail. Fired from last job due to alcoholic performance. Sold used cars 2 months. I just listed. I shot it back up to Toledo. A couple weeks, they said, could you come up for interviews? And I flew up to Toledo, and I remember that Monday morning. I flew up on a Sunday evening, and Monday morning I'm sitting across from this professional interviewer of Owens Corning Fiberglass. And all of a sudden this smile began to come over his face. And he said, you know, I can't ask you any of these questions, but he said, I have been dying to meet you because all the years I've been with the corporation, I've never seen a resume where a guy starts out in jail. The one ingredient that had plagued me all of my life was gone. I didn't have any fear that morning. He knew who I was, and he knew what I was, and I knew what I was, and we were on equal footing. The big book tells me I'm a child of God, and I don't have to crawl anymore. I don't have to do that anymore. And I went through the interviews that day, and the last interview was with a man that used to be my branch manager in Kansas City some 20 years prior. And the interview went like this. Albert, how's Sally and the kids? I said, hey, they're terrific, Dick. How's Marion and your kids? He said, super. You ready to come back? I said, you bet. And they bridged those years, and I went back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass. About 4 years ago, I had a heart attack. I'd been playing some racquetball, and I didn't have any pain. I just had a little pull in my shoulder, and Jack and I were talking about it today. And the following morning, you know, I went to work, and I had a business luncheon that day, and that evening, Sally and I had dinner, and it began to nag. And 11, 12 o'clock that night, Sally drove me down to the Presbyterian Hospital, not very far from where we live, and I said, I'm just going to have something for this shoulder. And the next thing I know, this guy said, you're going to feel better with these hoses up your nose and this IV in your arm and this nitro under your tongue, and you've had a heart attack. And I remember we went on up to intensive care, and I'm in the oxygen, and I'm wired for sound, and they have these little plaques that they're very rigid up there. It says family only limit two people, limit the visit 2 minutes. And it just Sally and one of the sons had been there and had just left, and I'm coming out of the oxygen, and as I opened up, there's a black guy that I sponsor, and he's standing there, and I said, how the hell did you get in here? He says, I told him I was family. I said, what did you tell him? He said, I told him you were my father. I got out of there, and I was attending a cardiovascular class at the aerobic center, and I had a second heart attack without any pain. They just went in for a routine physical, and they said, you've done some damage to the front of your heart. And so they said, we need to send you over to Medical City for an angiogram because you can't seem to monitor your disease. And I said, I've had that problem once before. So they took a look and said, hey, we need to do a triple bypass right away. I don't advocate open heart surgery for an in-depth third step, but I'll tell you this. The night before surgery, you understand you're not running anything. I mean, you understand how to let go the night before open heart surgery. And the thing that just took the breath away from Sally and I was that you surrounded us so rapidly with your love and your strength and your letters and your telegrams and your cards and your big books and grapevines and coffee pots. And, you know, nurses just come in and say, are you somebody special? I mean, we just drive them crazy in the hospital. And you want to say, oh, God, if you only knew. But, you know, the experience of that was, Sally and I have come to find out that good comes from all things. And we can handle anything. You know, as long as we stay with you. My security is with you. I've had to learn to become vulnerable. You know, Cloyd talked a little bit about this one. It's learning to become vulnerable. You know, as deep as I let you look in, that's as deep as I can look out. And I'll be vulnerable almost anywhere except with Sally, because that's the one that can hurt me the most. And I've had to learn to become vulnerable with Sally. A couple of years ago, the daughter was having problems, and she called and said, would you mind if I come down to Texas and spend a little time and bring the boys? And I said, when are you coming, honey? And she gave me the date, and I said, you may want to pick another weekend because Mom's going to be up at a woman-to-woman conference in Oklahoma. And she said, no, I think I'd like to come down and be with you, if you don't mind. And I said, no, I'd love it. And Roxy and the two grandsons came down to Dallas, and I'm a father that's still plagued with a certain amount of guilt that thinks materialistic things are going to make up for it. Roxy knows that she has to be careful because she says if she likes that building over there, Dad's apt to try and get it for her. And, you know, we did one of these dad and daughter things, and we went to North Park and we started to shop. And I had seen in the morning paper that Mel Torme and George Shearing were playing at the Fairmont, very fussy hotel in Dallas. And I just casually said to Roxy, how'd you like to go see George Shearing and Mel Torme? And she said, Dad, I just love it. And we tried to get a babysitter, and we couldn't find one. And all of a sudden, Roxy said to me, "Well, let me call Tom down in Houston. That's the brother. And maybe he'll fly up and babysit so you and I can go out on the town." And I took step one and just backed off. And sure enough, she called Tom. Tom flew up, and Roxy and I got all gussied up, and we went down to the Fairmont, and they seated us at the table, and the music started, and I said, "Roxy, would you like to dance?" And she said, "I just love it." And you know, I remember as I was holding Roxy and we were just kind of dancing, I heard her say to me, "You're absolutely the greatest dad in the whole world. You're the finest man that I know on the face of this earth." You know, I had worked a lifetime to have my daughter say that to me. But I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a good father or to be a good husband or to be a good anything. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the pain out. And you gave me a set of principles that made me a functioning human being. You gave me a set of principles that overpowers my personality. You gave me a set of principles that became attractive to my children because they hated the personality. My children told me they hated the personality. And yet they found the principles of this program so attractive that they came back. The son that got into drugs. I remember when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was crying at that halfway house that morning, and I said to this old retired electrical contractor, "My God, how are Sally and those kids going to get along without me?" And he said, "Just fine." I remember him saying, "If you really want to do something for them, you do something with you." You know, and as I was trying to do something with me, that young fellow that got into drugs graduated from the University of Iowa in art and decided to go to Texas to get his master's. And the guy that had backed out of the house just quietly went to Stephen F. Austin and got his degree in recreational forestry. But every once in a while, that 34-year-old, the disease of alcoholism, Cleve talked about it last night, if the disease is progressive, the ism is progressive. And every once in a while, he gets in trouble and he gets in jail. And not too long ago, they called and said he's in on 2 counts of criminal mischief. And I want to tell you, just like a trained seal, just like a father with a certain amount of guilt, I reached for the checkbook and said, "You know, how much is the attorney?" And I just took $2,000 from my account and wired it to his account. Because there's a certain amount of guilt in me that says I still have to do that. I knew it wasn't right, and I know I'm enabling him. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, they called again, and he was in jail one more time for harassment, and the bail was at $5,000. And Chuck was on the other end of the phone saying, "Dad, the bail is $5,000. And out of nowhere, I said to Chuck, "Chuck, I just don't care anymore. I just don't care. I care, but I care, but I don't care. You're just going to have to find your own way out." And somehow I heard his voice kind of say, "Okay, Dad." But I want to tell you, when I put the phone down, God, my heart was heavy. You know, 12 years I had never said no, and all of a sudden I said no, and I felt this feeling of abandonment, and God, I couldn't figure out which way to turn. And I called Sally's sponsor. I called an Al-Anon up in Norman, Oklahoma, and I said, "Vinoy, God, I just said no to my son for the first time in 12 years, and my heart is heavy." And his magnificent voice on the other end says, "Of course it's heavy, Albert. God, you love your kids, but you're not using the steps." "God, I know the steps, Vinoy." "Yeah, but you're not using them. Hey, let's take step one. You're powerless over your son. He makes your life unmanageable." I said, "Boy, that's right." He said, "A power greater than you is going to return him to sanity." "That's true. Why don't you turn his will and his life over to the care of God?" "Okay, Vinoy." And then Vinoy said to me, "I want you to write down 4 things in a hurry. Those things that make you feel guilty about your son." And I remember I took a pencil and the first thing I wrote down was made him do things that he didn't want to do when he was little. Because he had been gifted as an artist and as a poet and as a journalist. And he wanted to be by himself and he was an individual, creative type person, and when the sun was shining, I had my foot in his back saying, "You will play football, basketball, baseball. It's a competitive damn world out there, and you're going to learn to be a part of it." used to shove him up against the wall when he was about 15 or 16 after I'd been drinking a little bit. Say, if you just get your hair cut, if you just get your room picked up, if you just get to school on time, if you would just do what I tell you to do, you could be just like me. God, and those eyes were looking out saying, I'll do anything but be like you. A couple of days before Sally and I left to come to Hilton Head, I came home one evening and I turned the recorder on in my office, and it was Chuck. The voice was there, just says, hey Dad, wanted you to know my new telephone number. I've just moved and I want you to know where I am all the time. The middle boy that backed out, we've become partners in a couple of business things together. And every once in a while he just calls me and says, hey Pop, just called to tell you that I love you. And I hear that and I think, God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has just gifted me over and over again. The young son who was 27 who used to keep the loaded shotgun for me has run off to New York to be an actor. But about 7 months ago, he asked if we could play golf, and I said, you bet. And afterwards, he said, how about a little lunch? And I said, fine. And while we were talking, John said to me, Dad, sometimes I find myself drinking with people that I don't want to be with. Did that ever happen to you? I said, yeah. He said, sometimes I find myself drinking in places that I really don't want to be in. That happened to you? I said, yes. He said, sometimes I start out the evening with $200 or $300 and in the morning I only have $30 or $40 or $50 and I don't know where the money went. That ever happened to you? I said, yeah. He said, what do you think? I said, I don't know. I don't know whether you are alcoholic or not, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do for you what your mother's father did for me. I'm going to give you the names of two people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, their home phone and their business phone. And if the pain gets so great in your life, they have a way out. Because I'll tell you this, John, I'm your father and I would kill you. I love you enough to tell you that. You know, here's a boy that hated me so much he used to keep a loaded shotgun, who loves me so much he's willing to say, Dad, I have a problem. The relationship that I have with my children today is what I've wanted all of my life. It's nice to have a love affair going with your lady after 38 years. It took me a long time to find out that love is not looking at each other, it's looking in the same direction. We're so busy looking at each other, sometimes we forget which direction we're going. We learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon to give each other the dignity to be wrong. Every once in a while, the young people call and say, how do you and Sally do that? And I say, we have to work at it every day. We're still learning how to touch each other. We're still learning how to not be afraid of each other. We're still learning how to be vulnerable. Hey, we're still learning how to touch. You know, one of the things that I lost to alcohol was the sense of touch. You know, I was so busy loving the body, I didn't know what to do with the person. And it's taken me a long time to figure out. I could relate when Cleve said last night, you know, there are a lot of evenings that Sally and I sit together in the same room. We don't say 10 words to each other. But God, I'm just happy being in her presence. Nobody makes me feel as good as my lady. Nobody. I need Alcoholics Anonymous more tonight. Here with you. And with my wife. Then the first night I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is not much of a gamble if you don't have anything to lose. But as I stand here tonight, I have a lot to lose. And I know of Sally, and the four children, and the grandchildren, could come to this podium and stand where I'm standing. They would tell you what I'm about to tell you. We are very privileged to be in your presence. We love you very, very much.
We owe you our life. We adore you, and we thank you for asking us to be a part in your conference. Thank you so much.